SF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.
Quasi-cerebral talk and tunes. This is Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. Here's what we've got cooking up this hour. You are tuned in to Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. We're the campus community radio station broadcasting from Burnaby Mountain at Simon Fraser University, where we broadcast on the unceded Coast Salish territories of the Musqueam, Squamish, Tsleil-Waututh, and Kwikwetlem First Nations. This episode of Typically Tuesdays was produced on the unceded Coast Salish territories of the Ketse, Kwikwetlem, and Stolo First Nations. At Typically Tuesdays, we recognize the host nations as being the original storytellers and knowledge keepers of these lands, and we thank them for their stewardship. My name is Leslie, and today I've got a fun conversation for you. My good friend Sam and I bond over our shared love for pop stars and girl groups and idols, and this week, in a talk-heavy episode of Typically Tuesdays, we are going to be chatting all about the latest, hottest, rising global girl group sensation, Cat's Eye. We'll be talking about the documentary series that they appeared on Netflix, which is called Pop Star Academy Cat's Eye. And then we're going to be talking a lot about the group itself, trying to figure out if it is a global girl group, an American girl group, or a K-pop group. We'll be talking about the ways in which popular culture and pop media try to appropriate the language and concepts and theories around progressive social political movements, particularly in the case of Cat's Eye, anti-racism and diversity, and equity and inclusion. And because we love girl groups and we both quite enjoy Cat's Eye, you have to also understand that this is a conversation that was frankly a little bit messy, in the sense that it was quite disorganized. You know, you get two fangirls together, you put them into a confined space, as in like the concept of space, not an actual physical space, and you allow them to essentially unhinge their skulls and to allow all of their emotions, thoughts, viewpoints, and feelings out about the thing that they love, and it just becomes chaos and unhinged. And so throughout today's episode, I'll actually be popping in as the editing Leslie to make clarifications on talking points and to summarize things that we would have discussed and kept banging on about for minutes at a time. That is today's show. A little bit messy, a little bit disorganized, definitely fangirlish. And if you enjoy a girl group, and even if you don't, this one's going to be a ride, so strap in. Get ready for the conversation after this public service announcement here on Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM.
This is Bird Note. Just what puts the hum in a hummingbird's wings? And why don't other birds' wings hum in flight? To figure it out, scientists used a specially built rig to measure air pressure, 12 high-speed cameras, and over 2,000 microphones to observe hummingbirds fluttering in place at an artificial flower. This allowed them to make 3D visualizations of the sound of a hummingbird's wing beats. When hummingbirds flap, they create lift both on the downstroke and the upstroke, so twice per wing beat. The researchers found that the hum derives from the difference in air pressure between the top and the bottom of the wings, which alternates 40 times a second as the hummingbird flaps. The rapidly shifting air pressure produces a harmonic set of sounds from low to high, creating that iconic musical hum. Other birds flap with power on the downstroke only, so there's no rapidly changing pressure difference when they fly, making them much quieter. Their wings might whoosh, but only a hummingbird's hum. For BirdNote, I'm Ariana Remmel.
Welcome back to Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. I'm Leslie.
And I'm Sam.
Today we are together because it can only mean one thing.
Idols.
Idols. We're talking about idols. Of course, a Typically Tuesday classic, a Sam and Leslie classic since May when we interviewed
Non-Sweet,
which was incredible. Today we are here in a local park recording this episode because we will not be confined to spaces and limits. We are limitless. There will be no borders. We're imagining a world without borders.
Kind of like the subject of this talk, which is global girl groups, specifically Cat's Eye.
So Cat's Eye, right? It's this six-member girl group created by HYBE and Geffen. They're technically an idol group. HYBE, if you don't know, they are a very successful K-pop production company that has produced some of the biggest acts in K-pop right now, such as BTS, Le Sserafim, NewJeans, and Hyphen, and the list goes on. Geffen, of course, is an American music production company that has at one point signed with the likes of like Cher, Kylie Minogue. Currently, some of their stars include Olivia Rodrigo and Camila Cabello. Me out here only naming women. Very, very me. But also Elton John is one of the people who used to be signed on to Geffen. So these are two companies that are really, really big right now in terms of like music production and in entertainment. In the world of popular music. Now, Cat's Eye itself is made up of six members, as I mentioned earlier. Do you want to count down the people in Cat's Eye, Sam? Give us the name and also where they're from and their cultural background, because that will be a point of discussion in the show. Not to profile them or anything like that, but it's relevant to our discussion.
Yes, so the final members of the group, and we'll explain why they're the final members in a bit.
Sounds kind of like a horror movie.
Yeah, the final members. The six members are Manon, who is from Switzerland, Sophia, who is from the Philippines, Lara, who's American, but her ethnicity is Indian, and Megan, who is from Hawaii. But she's also mixed Chinese and white. Yunche, who's from Korea, and Daniela, who's from America but is also Cuban Venezuelan.
Yeah. And just to give a further breakdown, maybe because this is also kind of relevant in some ways, I guess. It's kind of relevant in some ways. So Manon, who is, as mentioned before, from Switzerland, she's mixed race, Swiss-Italian, I believe, and Ghanaian. And as well, Lara, who was mentioned earlier, she has Tamil ancestry. This group was created out of a training program created by HYBE and Geffen, which originally was just supposed to be essentially a K-pop boot camp.
Mm-hmm.
It's if you've listened to the program before, you've probably heard of me talk extensively about groups like Me I, which was created from Produce 101 Japan,
and perhaps even about New Jeans or other groups like that. These groups are created out of a really rigorous and structured training regimen that the K-pop entertainment industry has championed. That structure is inspired by the J-pop idol star system from the 70s and 80s into the 90s and the 2000s. The Korean entertainment industry took many aspects of it, was very influenced by it, and made it more maybe like more focused and more compartmentalized, in the sense that people who go through this training, they have to go through vocal lessons, they have to do dance lessons, they even have to learn how to like brand themselves and create like a persona, a brandable persona.
They also have to learn how to serve face.
Daniela cannot serve face at the beginning, guys. I know, it's hard to believe.
Before we go further, just because I do want to avoid us getting doxxed.
Okay.
Sam.
Yes.
Do you like Cat's Eye?
I do.
Okay, good. I also like Cat's Eye. So let's get that out of the way.
We are not haters.
We're not haters, but we are people who have critical thinking skills.
Yes.
And we have thoughts and opinions. Yeah, but to get back to the point of this program, they would be signed on to HYBE GEFFEN, this production company, and then they would undergo this rigorous training in which they literally have to like sometimes get leveled up, and girls sometimes, if they don't pass an examination on, let's say, vocal lessons or dance lessons, they gotta go home. This is all seen in the new Netflix documentary, quote unquote documentary series called
Popstar Academy.
Cat's Eye.
The documentary shows us the 2 or so year long process of putting together Cat's Eye, first starting with auditioning hundreds of girls from all around the world to select 20 who will enter HYBE GEFFEN's training and development program. They will train in the program for a year. Then they are unconsensually thrusted into the throes of an audition show or an idol survival show called Dream Academy. During the competition, there are 4 challenges where trainees are put into groups and they have to compete against each other. They're in performances of covers of certain songs. Those covers are filmed, then they are uploaded onto YouTube, and notably the communication platform created by HYBE, which allows fans to communicate with idols, and that's called Weverse. Audience members then vote for their favorite contestant, and there is also disclosed quite a bit of decision making made by the producers of HYBE and GEFFEN based on how the audience votes for their favorite contestants. Contestants are then eliminated based off of the popularity of their votes and also based off of how the producers want the group to continue to move on, I guess. And then at the very end, we are left with 6 trainees who end up becoming Cat's Eye.
For you, I watched it, I'd say, right when it came out, which was maybe a month ago. And honestly, this document, I guess, made me appreciate the group more. Like, before, I'd only, like, watched a few of their music videos. But after this docuseries, I was, like, hooked. So the first few episodes were kind of an introduction to the 20 or so girls. They all lived together. They all were training for many hours a day. One girl got sent home pretty early because she didn't fit the requirements. And yeah, the first few episodes just show them working towards that K-pop training regimen. And at this point, none of the girls know that they're going to be put into a competition show and essentially be pitted against each other. Like, I binged the first few episodes, which was just the girls, like, training and working hard. And I actually found it inspiring. Even, like, when Manon came in, she was chosen by the casting director just because she's beautiful. Pace. She's beautiful.
Did I say serves pace? She serves pace. Yeah.
And she was 21, I think, when she started in the show, maybe. But she had no vocal training and no dance training. A lot of these girls either had purely dance training, purely vocal training, or like Manon, nothing. And I found it really fascinating how they evolved through each episode. Like, I love Megan now, but seeing her at the early stages, I'm sorry, girl, you cannot carry it too. And Daniela, you cannot serve face. Don't come for me. Icons, I'm sorry if you're listening. Icons are the fandom name of Cat's Eye, for those of you who do not know. At the start, it seemed pretty typical. Kind of like a Dance Moms-esque training, where they spent like 10 hours a day dancing and singing. Okay. They were working hard.
Yeah.
But a lot of these girls were also under 18, and they didn't really delve into the education. Were they being schooled, or were they dancing for 10 hours? I have no idea. As a woman in academia myself, I'm concerned. Yeah, what are your thoughts?
You know, with any, like, reality thing, be it a documentary or a show, it's always going to... Storylines have to be produced. There's always going to be editing and, like, some form of scripting, right? Even the questions that are being asked technically are a part of the writing and the storytelling of the program. And so in the beginning, I just found that it made me so angry, I think, because knowing of music acts who are independent, and even idol groups who are independent, like Non-Sweet, you know, like, it's really feels weird for me to hear these multi-million, probably billion-dollar companies being like, this has to work well or else we're going to lose everything. It's a huge risk. This is exactly what any big company would say.
Mm-hmm.
They want to only make profits. They don't want to lose money. And what that also ends up being kind of meaning is like, as a viewer, you get to think about the other side, which is like, okay, so that kind of sounds like BS. Then who is actually going to end up losing a lot? Well, it's these girls who have signed on to this program, who have not been informed about the full nature of the program,
mm-hmm.
right? And who are going to be exposing themselves, their very young and impressionable selves, to rabid and unhinged audiences, and also, frankly, audiences that are really mean a lot of the times,
mm-hmm.
and even audiences like you and me, who we don't have bad intentions, but it's not always nice to hear criticism,
mm-hmm. right?
It doesn't always feel good. And these are also contestants, some of whom who don't come from a lot of means. There are clearly people on this program who come from wealthy backgrounds, and if they can't debut in this group, if they waste, you know, a year and a half in this training program and they don't make it, they're, you know, they can go back to school, or they can you know, pursue, like, different means of pursuing their dreams. And then there are other contestants who literally had to leave everything.
Mm-hmm.
There's a contestant who is named Ilya. She's literally a refugee,
mm-hmm.
right? And she had to...
She was the only one supporting her family.
Mm-hmm.
So she was the only income stream for her household, and she essentially left for a year hoping this would succeed for her. And then you have Hab Geffen being like, we'll never be able to financially recover.
Yeah. You also have a contestant like Samara, right? Who, mm-hmm. who comes from, she mentions it throughout the program. You know, she is racialized. She's black. And also, she comes from a poor family, right? She goes on to say, you know, these are opportunities that people like me don't get, which is why this is so important to me. I don't know. In that sense, I feel like, in terms of storytelling, Ivan Geffen really shot themselves in the foot, in my opinion. It kind of makes them seem like...
entitled?
Yeah, entitled. Bunch of a-holes, mm-hmm. right? The other thing that I think I do have to credit them for, though, is the setup of the reality competition show, which many people who did not follow the actual streaming show would not have known about.
Mm-hmm.
So they put it on Netflix, probably, you know, another quote-unquote financial risk or whatever. But what I think they do really well is that they establish most of the contestants beforehand, before they get into the competition of it. Because I think if they focused only on the competition for Western audiences, that would be really, really jarring. Like, if I showed you Produce 101, for example, unless you, let's say, watched a lot of reality competition series, or more specifically, unless you've watched Drag Race, a lot of Drag Race, you would probably be quite shocked by the intensity of emotion in those programs. You have like entire 1.5 hour episodes dedicated to people crying because they're getting eliminated.
Oh.
Right? But by I think making the documentary in this way, where we're gonna establish our contestants, we're gonna talk about their training, and then we're gonna go into the reality competition show. It gives viewers who are not as into idols like this cushion, mm-hmm. to understand, like, okay, why is training and development so important in these idol groups? What do they look like? How rigorous are they? I mean, again, there were a number of contestants who trained so hard that they had broken bones, which is not uncommon with people who dance a lot or move their bodies a lot. But I get concerned when a 16-year-old has to have hip surgery.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm.
If you're just tuning into the radio right now, you're listening to Typically Tuesdays on CJSF 90.1 FM. I'm Leslie.
And I'm Sam.
We're talking about the international global girl group pop rising star sensations, Cat's Eye.
Spelled with a K.
Spelled with a K. I have burning questions for you, because mm-hmm. I'm really interested in the concept of a global girl group, and I'm also really interested in the globalization of idols. Mm-hmm. This is something that you know, and of course the listener knows as well. So I established earlier that Cat's Eye is supposed to be a global girl group, in the sense that all of the members come from different parts of the world. Traditionally, a K-pop girl group, usually everybody is either from Korea, or they're from Korea and East Asia, other countries in East Asia, or they're from Korea and other countries in East Asia and also in Southeast Asia. There's a bit more globalization in that sense these days, but Cat's Eye is a little bit different.
Editing Leslie here, so I had to cut out the section where I was going on and on about nothing, and Sam and I had to hard pivot to a different discussion. And that discussion is around discourse about what type of group Cat's Eye actually is. There's been some confusion amongst people who are interested in the group, in the fandom, and adjacent, who are not sure. Are Cat's Eye a global girl group? Are they an American girl group? Or are they a K-pop group? So that's what we discuss from here.
Why do you think Cat's Eye is a K-pop group?
Well, not only was their training rigorously based off the K-pop training regimen. But the events they're attending, like they're flying to Korea and they're promoting themselves a lot there. The girls are learning how to speak Korean. And they appeared on like Music Bank and those types of shows.
Which is like a Korean pop music show akin to like an old school kind of like MTV music show where the stars come on and they perform their single of the day.
Mm-hmm. So there's that aspect. Do you have anything to add about why you think it's a K-pop group?
I consider Cat's Eye to be a K-pop group largely because of the first point that you made, which is that they're produced from the K-pop training star system, or the K-pop training and development system. The way that the company brands the group, even though they say it's a global girl group, everything seems very K-pop-filled to me. And I know this because I've been a K-pop fan for far too long. But, like, even like, the creation of, like, their own little, like, universe, right? Like, these members have...
They have dream symbols. I think that's what they're called.
Dream symbol?
Yeah, each one has, like, a dream symbol. Kind of like how in the non-sweet interview we talked about idol colors. They each have their own dream symbol.
Exactly. That's a really big thing right now in K-pop. And even something like the name of their debut album, which is called Soft is Strong, is all very K-pop pilled as well. Because the idea is, like, we've got some songs that are soft, which are mellow, slower in tempo. They're a little bit more romantic and gentle. And then you've got strong songs with a stronger concept. High tempo, bolder. They're maybe less romantic and more about, like, quote-unquote, female empowerment and stuff like that, mm-hmm. right? And that's something that you see in K-pop all the time. Like, Red Velvet is a really good example where they're called Red Velvet because they have the side of them that's red, that's bold, that's a very fierce, and they've got another side of them that's velvet, that's gentle, smooth, sensual. Twice, even, the group that you and I share a deep bond about. Their concept used to be called Candy Pop.
Mm-hmm.
Color Pop, which was this idea that, like, they're creating pop music that's all colorful. And so they're never going to release a song that's, you know, like a Red Velvet, like, sensual, kind of, like, slow R&B. But they're going to release stuff that's, like, a little bit cuter, a little bit more feminine.
Mm-hmm.
All ages in that way. Even just the way that they're, like, marketed feels very K-pop to me. And I think that would make sense because their art director, right? Their art directors are people who have worked in the K-pop industry. And because it's like the collaboration between a K-pop production company and an American production company, they would want to take the things that work in K-pop that mm-hmm. really speak right now to, I think, a lot of like online culture, a lot of like fandom culture. K-pop fans are rabid and unhinged. And they're really good at streaming music. You know what I mean?
And buying merch.
So that's why I think they're a K-pop group, personally.
I agree. And also even the way they presented their EP album style is kind of like a lookbook.
Yeah. I guess so. Because for them, it would also be like, they've got a photo book.
Mm-hmm.
They've got several versions of the album, and you gotta buy all of them. They've got stickers and other kinds of, like, maybe like a photo card in there or something. And that's not you know, that's not exactly something that you're going to get from, like, a Florence and the Machine album. Yeah. If you're just tuning in to Typically Tuesdays right now, which is totally not a global girl group at all, it's usually a one-woman operation in Vancouver, of all places. Yeah, you're listening to Typically Tuesdays.